I know the late Professor Leon Rosenfeld in Copenhagen used to say that the new Scientific American was the greatest invention to come out of America. And I don't know how one makes that kind of a judgment, but it is a tremendous accomplishment because after the war, it became clear to some people that the importance of scientists communicating to the public was much greater than it had been before. And I'm sure that Gerard Piel and his colleagues realized that because they did produce this amazing publication. It's amazing in many ways that it does bring science to the layman. It does this with tremendously high professional standards. It has a uniformity about it. One wonders, in fact, whether any of the people who write, and we have a number of people in the audience who have written articles, whether they've written them themselves or whether Gerard writes them all himself. But it has these very high professional standards and reaches a large audience. Dr. Peel, and he is Dr. Peel, he got, among other things, an honorary degree from this university a few years ago. He's had a career, after graduating from Harvard, he had a career in journalism with Life magazine, but most of his career has been really building this publication. And we thought that was such an impressive achievement that even though he visits here, well, on a number of occasions, he was here last summer, we should invite him back really to talk about that subject, his own subject, the Scientific American. And that's what we're hearing tonight.
I thank you, Dr. Vogt. We're all in for something of an experience this evening. In the first place, this is the most extraordinary privilege I've ever had accorded to me, to be asked to expatiate on my favorite subject. And you are at considerable risk. You may find me going on as long as Fidel Castro or Leonid Brezhnev or the even more interminable and always even more fascinating R. Buckminster Fuller. But I shall try to keep this within the bounds of a reasonable evening's discourse and at the same time to share with you the aspects of Scientific American that I feel most importantly. Eric Boat asked me this evening whether I was going to start with 1948. Well, I really couldn't have this opportunity to talk about Scientific American without beginning with 1845, because that's when the magazine was founded. It was founded by an extraordinary original Native American named Rufus Porter. He was one of the Yankee mechanics that gave America, pretty much through their own self-appraisal, or at least as much through their self-appraisal as through their actual performance, the reputation for Yankee ingenuity. He was a tinker and a peddler. He was also something of an artist, and first came to note, having been forgotten for more than half a century, when the historians of American art rediscovered him and found that in the northern counties of Massachusetts and the southern tier counties of New Hampshire and Vermont and Maine, there are 150 houses in which the parlors and dining rooms and the front hallways were covered with murals painted by Rufus Porter. He developed his own fresco style, applying the paint to wet plaster, and they're charming pictures. He started Scientific American in 1845 as a vehicle of his own personal philosophy, which was a Yankee mechanics version of 18th century enlightenment. The conviction, as Jefferson put it, that so long as we may think as we will and speak as we think, the condition of man must proceed in improvement. And it was to this that Scientific American was dedicated. He stayed with it about 2 or 3 years, and as he said, I've now established the publication on secure footing and have been able to negotiate on favorable terms with a succeeding publisher. And he took the $25 he got for selling his goodwill and his type box off to found the Aerial Navigation Company to build a dirigible, which was to be made of lath and a light canvas and inflated with hydrogen, and have hanging below it a gondola, 220 feet long, below it a gondola with a charcoal-burning steam engine aboard. Fortunately, the chimney of the steam engine ventilating well downstream behind the tail of the of what he called the spheroidal spindle, his balloon, and a screw propeller, and ailerons for elevation and for steering. He advertised it as a safe and convenient way to reach California in 7 days. And this was during the gold rush, so it had a market. He tried to get the Congress of the United States to give him the funds. He tried to get it from rich investors. He finally sold common stock at $5 a share and raised all of $1,500 and actually started building the thing. In the course of raising the funds, he demonstrated a 1/10 scale model, which in the annals of aeronautics may turn out to have been the first demonstration of a self-powered flying machine. And a 1/10 scale model was a considerable affair, a 22-foot long dirigible, which he flew inside of armories and big chambers like this that were to be found in the cities of the Eastern Seaboard, from Boston down through New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, and Washington. And the newspapers of those towns have contemporary accounts of the remarkable flight of this balloon. Well, the magazine under his successors was published for a century before we took it over. It carries one of the really best contemporary accounts of the American Industrial Revolution. And we have an American historian of science at work now. We persuaded him to become interested in the project, and we hope to publish in a year or two a rather comprehensive picture of the American Industrial Revolution out of the volumes of the old magazine. We, who now publish it, took the magazine over in 1947, publishing our first issue in May 1948. And as Eric Vogt has said, we recognized the need for a good magazine of science. And we being Dennis Flanagan, who was editor of the magazine, and Donald Miller, who was our business manager, and myself, came to this conviction, that is Flanagan and I, when we were working on Life magazine. I was science editor of that magazine. I was made science editor of Life because my bachelor's degree from Harvard was a certificate of illiteracy in science. And the managing editor of Life decided that he ought to have science in the magazine. He didn't understand it or know anything about it himself. He figured he should have an editor that didn't. And our pact was that if I would work at it and would explain it to him, and he and I would work together to produce the stories. Maybe the readers of Life could begin to get the story. Well, he kept his word and took my effort seriously, and science became a very important part of Life magazine's coverage of the world. And I wish you all might have in your memories the magazine of those days. This was from 1938 through 1945, when John Billings, my boss, retired, and the magazine started going downhill from then. But it was a magazine I could be proud to work for at that time. And with a sympathetic editor, I did things that I could be proud of. But what impressed me most was that as I published one story and then the next scientist I went to enlist in the task of producing the next story was the more ready to work with me, because he had read the last one. And I discovered that the most intense readers of what I was, of the little words I was putting under the big pictures that I was putting into Life magazine, were scientists and engineers. The science department had isolated out of the 4 million circulation of Life an audience of its own. And when we recognized that, we were challenged by the thought that these readers deserve much better attention and much better treatment than we're able to give them in a general and picture magazine addressed to a diverse and otherwise unspecified audience. And so we went out and raised the money to start a new publishing enterprise and bought the old magazine from the Munn family that had published it for that century after Rufus Porter had sold it to them. We started with a circulation of an optical illusion for a circulation of 40,000. The magazine actually had only 1,000 direct-to-publisher live human being subscribers who were still reading the magazine because they were devoted to a column written by Albert G. Ingalls, which was devoted month after month to the art of figuring a telescope mirror, how to get from the spherical to the parabolic surface. And Albert Ingalls managed to fill that rather narrow subject with such fascination that every month for 20 years he wrote a column in the magazine about it. There were 5,000 libraries. The last advertiser that the magazine still claimed welcomed me to the office when I rolled up the rolled top desk of the former proprietor with a cancellation of the balance of his contract. That was Bell Labs. So we started from scratch. Today, Scientific American, just to give you the picture of the economic entity, has a circulation of 650,000. It is a fully paid circulation. Publishers can buy as large a circulation as they please to spend the money to buy them. And most publishers in America these days are giving their magazines away in order to produce inflated circulations to sell their pages at larger page prices to advertisers. And circulation figures don't mean much. Ours does. Third-party studies of our readership tell us that of all magazines published in America, we have the highest concentration of educated people. And our own studies suggest that we have something like 1.8 academic degrees per capita among our subscribers. They are concentrated to the degree of about a half to two-thirds in the sciences and in engineering, and the balance are not elsewhere classified laymen. 100,000 of our circulation is outside of North America. 30,000 of it is here in Canada. 100,000, 110,000 now on the newsstands. We have a larger newsstand circulation than Sports Illustrated, U.S. News and World Report, or The New Yorker. This is a magazine with a live and active relationship with its readers, and exists above all to serve its readers. And the readers and the editors, in their close rapport, make an almost self-sufficient economic entity out of it. We do require advertising income to stay in business and also to do the other things we want to do. And we are getting, beginning to get more like what ought to be our share of it. The advertising that we're selling reflects the fact that the readers of our magazine play a decisive and central role in contemporary economic life. You know that I'm sure that the same figures are true of Canada as of the United States, that the population we're talking of, the scientists and engineers, have been increasing at the rate of 7% per annum as far back as the statistical series goes. And a 7% per annum increase is a 10-year doubling, which means that the last time we doubled in the United States, 750,000 additional scientists and engineers were added to the cadres in these professions in America. And this means that they are young. And this means that they are a rising and increasingly influential body of citizens engaged in making professional decisions about the most crucial questions in the economic life of our country and of other countries. So it is a young audience, highly educated, and engaged in primarily in the scientific and engineering occupations. We have now two foreign language editions, one in Japan and published in Japanese. It's the issue before last, published this month, translated into Japanese. And the Japanese, you know, are the most super literate people on earth. They not only have to know about 4,000 Chinese kanji characters to be literate, but they also know two phonetic alphabets, and they can read them up or down and from left or from right to left or from left to right. They accept the conventions of our publication and set it from left to right and in columns. And we have a circulation in Japan of 30,000. We have a similar edition in Italy in the Italian language with a circulation of going on to 60,000. So if we add those circulations, we're up over 700,000 circulation around the world. And we may find our way into other languages. We have a textbook publishing subsidiary called W.H. Freeman and Company. And I'm sure their books are in use here. We came together because Freeman was a smart enough publishing organization to recognize the aftermarket in educational institutions for what we have published in the magazine. And they package our articles in various forms for sale to teachers as supplementary reading and up-to-date reading in every field of science. So there is the economic entity. Now, the essence, of course, of this economic entity is the fact that this magazine serves a significant cultural need in contemporary society. I have to say that we have not solved the big problem, the two culture problem, that was advertised by C.P. Snow and Jay Bronofsky. We have made what we hope and will hope to continue to make something of a contribution to a lesser but I think equally important problem, which is communications within the sciences. As is suggested by our readership, we are serving the interests of people who are interested in science and who are working in science. Now, Brunovsky was once kind enough to credit me as the author of the statement that the greatest invention of science is science itself, which is a way of saying that the essence of Western civilization is the invention of the disciplines of knowledge. The work of science requires high specialization, and from year to year, as the I love that Indian sort of Hindu image of the expanding sphere of knowledge, which increases our contact everywhere with the unknown. But as the sphere expands, the disciplines radiating, let's say in this imaginary model from the center, are further and further apart at the periphery. And the problem this is advertised as the great problem of the sciences. But what is the essence of the problem here is that we're confronted here with a paradox, because as we advance knowledge with the proliferation of specializations, we're also living in a period of the marvelous convergence of these disciplines on great questions. And we are talking about a unified body of knowledge. And we are, of course, are talking about an absolutely glorious and always eluding us, but always attainable objective, which is the attainment, ultimately, of an interconnected and self-consistent explanation of the universe and of ourselves in it. And the division of the sciences into a kind of Tower of Babel is strictly a technological question and a technological necessity involved in getting the work done. It was our conviction that all of the interests and concerns and work of science could be expressed and written about in the language of educated men, and in above all, the marvelous and flexible and capacious English language. And it is this unity of knowledge and interrelationship of knowledge that our magazine serves. We do not think that, and certainly the progress of science shows that there is no need to settle for the easy compromise of any dualism of knowledge. Of course, men will always have, our humanist friends speak of that other way of knowing. I don't think there's any other way of knowing. We do have impressions, we have perceptions, we have feelings, but to the extent that we will ever truly understand them as a part of the body of verifiable and objective knowledge related by rational processes to the total web of life and of our existence, it will be as scientific knowledge and as knowledge sharply defined as verifiable and objective. And I don't see any boundary to that enterprise, although I don't see it, on the other hand, ever being complete and ever coming to an end. This is the endless quest for understanding, but from its very beginnings, Newtonian physics overthrew the dualism of heaven and earth and demonstrated that the laws of motion on earth were the laws of motion of the planet. Lyell ended the dualism of time, of the before and after creation, with the
And Darwin ended the dualism of special creation. And Pasteur, the dualism of vitalism. And then in our own time, Einstein eliminates the dualism of the ether and its content. And therewith also the dualism of matter and energy. While dualism will continue to afflict and limit our common sense and supplies of convenient and nitwitted first approximation analysis of reality, as for example the besetting debate of the behavioral scientists as between genetics and environment, nature and nurture. While this old habit of common sense still limits and afflicts the rational process, and our common sense comprehension of the world around us, the quest for the interconnected and unified body of understanding about the world moves forward and triumphantly has moved from physics into the life sciences and now into behavior. And science is, of course, not a quarry or a gravel pit. It's a consistent fabric, an interrelated web and structure of knowledge. And it is that picture that our magazine seeks to report. And through the going on 30 years that we have published Scientific American, we have seen a succession of the most magnificent expansions and revolutions in human understanding on the grandest questions there are before us. The understanding of the universe on wavelengths outside of the visible wavelength has now made it evident that the most titanic processes move forward in time periods that are within the range of human perception, that entire galaxies explode and leave remnants that are represented by the incomprehensible black hole. And this has happened in the brief period that we have been publishing Scientific American. Geology in this period has acquired a general theory. And a good part of it was supplied by that wonderful Canadian J. Tuzo Wilson. And it was a delight to publish his article in our pages back in 1962 when the stratigraphic geologists were still having apoplexy at the mention of the proposition. In the time that we've been publishing Scientific American, this brief period, we have come to an entirely new picture of the ancestry of the human species. The first toolmakers, it turns out, were little primates under 100 pounds in weight that still use their hands for walking. And it has become clear that toolmaking was itself a part of the selective and of the biological evolutionary process that made us. That the making of the tool closed some feedback loop, perhaps, in the primate brain that made it possible to begin to form purpose. And in fact, there is evidence in the geological, in the paleontological record of human behavior, and it has been eloquently said by Edward Deavy, that the stone tool is the most common fossil of the Pleistocene, though there are not many bones of the 100 billion ancestors that preceded us on this earth. But there is evidence that value began to be framed by those by pre-Homo pre-Homo sapiens species. The unraveling of the genetic code in this period is, of course, a famous story. One of its primary consequences is the deeper understanding of speciation and of biological identity at the biochemical level. And one of the lessons that comes out of it is the lesson that says that all of us in this room differ from one another on the substitution of amino acids in the protein chains that make up our bodies by a greater diversity that separates us as individuals than that those tiny differences that distinguish any members of us here who are members of different races. That only about 15% of the total biochemical diversity of our bodies is attributable to those superficial aspects that distinguish the human species into the races. This is a finding that tells us that we must see an end to the dualism of truth and value, an end to the shabby compromise that says that science is not as responsible for questions of value as it is for questions of truth. Just as in the humanities, scholars are confronted with facing the truth as well as with questions of value. Because on the evidence of biochemistry, it is now forever impossible again to make social policy on the basis of differentiation of mankind into different species, into different races, into pseudo-species that have been the ground of so much outrage and indignity committed by one human society upon another, or by minorities in power upon majorities in their power. And I could go on speaking with warmth and enthusiasm of revolutions in technology that have been covered in our pages in this brief period. But one really does deserve and requires mention, and this is the revolution in that is rooted under the heading of the computer, that follows from the breakthroughs in solid state physics that came within this past 30-year period. The computer and the solid-state circuit uses flea power to move information around. It almost moves information in the form of individual quanta of electrons, and may soon be doing it with individual photons of light. In consequence of the enormous versatility and virtuosity with which information can be handled and manipulated by this development in technology, the human nervous system is beginning to be disengaged from the production process in the economic life of industrial societies, just as much as the human muscle has been disengaged from the production process. This is a development that romantics can deplore, and the romantics that look back on the good old days always forget that it's very likely that if they lived in those good old days, they'd be among the 80% at the bottom of society living in deprivation and poverty. The work from which people are disengaged by the elimination of the drudgery that is laid upon the nervous system is just as unworthy of the human capacity as the work that used to be laid on human muscle in the hewing of wood and drawing of water. And so with this development in technology, increasing numbers of people will be freed to exercise their higher faculties that identify us as human beings. And it is out of such developments that it now begins to be in Canada as in America that something like half of our next generation growing up have an opportunity to continue their educations into higher education. And it becomes not only possible but necessary because of displacement of people from the labor force for people to find ways into continuing education and similar ways of occupying their time because the production process doesn't need them. And what I suppose those who are distressed at the thought of who have romance about craftsmanship can be cheered by the thought that these developments make it possible to bring craftsmanship back into our culture and without the economic incentive to drive it, but the purely artistic and aesthetic incentive. Now, the volumes of Scientific American that report the last 30 years of work in the sciences, we hope in another year will be more accessible to the reader through the publication of a topical index, which is now in preparation, and that extraordinary record will be available as a kind of current encyclopedia to the work of science. We think of our readers as interested laymen. That is to say, the criterion that qualifies a reader for our magazine is interest. It became clear to us early in our lives that the most interested people were people who work in research. And the next most interested are people who work in the application of science through the engineering disciplines. And the third most interested are not elsewhere classified laymen like myself, who through their experience in life become involved in the activities of the advance and application of science. The interested layman, we assume, is not informed and has no information about the field in which a given article is written. But a more important criterion to challenge the author and the editor is to recognize that we talk to a non-captive audience. The typical Scientific American author has the problem, and it's one with which we are fully sympathetic, that comes out of the fact that most of the time he is addressing captive audiences. He's addressing his students, and of course the most captive are his graduate students, or he is addressing his colleagues in his field of learning. And they have to listen to what he says, and in fact they're prepared to understand what he says because they come to him equipped with a good deal of background to understand the next new thing that he has to add to their understanding and knowledge. Well, the Scientific American author has to back away and take a completely different approach to the readers of our magazine. He's got to begin, and to the extent that he does not, we are there to help him reach the non-captive reader with the statement of his problem and his question. The author of the article in our magazine is most often the author of the work about which the article is concerned. He is most often invited by us to write the article. Frequently, and we do depend on our friends in the sciences to give us leads and tips and counsel. And we do not have a formal board of advisors. We rather keep ourselves in touch with an totally informal and always changing network of people in the sciences who share their enthusiasms with us and whose enthusiasms we can then check and verify by consultation with colleagues in their own field and in neighboring fields. And it is with this kind of help that we steer our magazine into new subjects and new fields of work. Because we publish the original writings of scientists, we represent the single channel in American society between the university and the public at large. It is the one publication, the one forum in which what goes on in universities becomes accessible and available to readers outside. The articles are the product of a collaboration of the editors of our magazine and the authors. It's a collaboration that is always painstaking and sometimes painful, in that a manuscript may require a considerable overhaul to be converted from a technical paper into a magazine article that will engage and hold the readership of a non-captive audience. And to the extent that any of you find that an article gets over your head after the third or fourth paragraph, we, as editors, have failed you. We are the representatives of our readers in the transaction of the author and the reader. Out of our early experience as editors of Life magazine, we depend and learned to use illustrations to take some of the stress and strain off of English prose. And if you ever take a ruler out and make the measurements and then the calculations, you'll find that about half of the editorial space in our magazine is devoted to illustration. And it is to illustrations that we now turn this evening's discourse. Oh, thanks. This cover of Scientific American was the cover of the September 1953 issue devoted to fundamental questions in science. The painting is by Walter Murch and now hangs in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. It reminds me to mention the typographic and aesthetic design of the magazine. You'll note that we do not use the sans serif type with which heavy machinery is labeled and with which science is so often identified in the public prints. It is rather the Trajan column and the identification of science with our culture that is suggested by the typography of Scientific American. Oh, sorry. Now I know how to use it, I think. Yes. This picture of bird skins from the collection of the American Museum of Natural History is by Rudolf Freund. And it illustrates something about our views of the philosophy of science. We're not Kantians. We give you here das Ding an sich, and there's no doubt that about where we think reality is. In this cover, we have an engineering drawing animated into action. Now, most of our illustrations are themselves documents from the work of science. This is true especially, of course, in astronomy, and where we've always depended upon the telescope. But some new and wonderful things have been developing in recent years. Here we have a picture of a solar prominence that has been made with instruments other than the camera that record the output of solar energy on different wavelengths and make the record on photographic film in different colors, which the astronomers call false color. It's not, of course, the real color of the phenomenon itself, but the different colors give us the output of energy in different wavelengths of the spectrum, and show us the ensemble in a sense-making way. This is a demonstration of the new ways in which understanding comes in astronomy. I showed this picture last summer to a member of the Academy of Science of the People's Republic of Mongolia, who was at our house, and he said, "Oh, the moon." "No, it's Mercury." And Mercury is the one planet about which we get better information by the spaceship flybys than we do from Earth-bound observatories. And this picture of Mercury, of a crater on Mercury, is one of the spectacular ones that came from that marvelously successful mission that has made now three encounters with Mercury. This is a crater from the planet, on the planet Venus, which was produced by radar from the Arecibo radio telescope in Puerto Rico, and the radar waves penetrating the thick and of the Martian landscape. This formation here is Nyx Olympicus, a mountain that is something like 30 kilometers in height with 4 kilometer high cliffs around its base. And with its lava flows toward the bottom of the picture, this is convincing evidence that Mars, in addition to having the crater scarred surface, such as our moon has, also had active volcanic processes. And here is the map of Mars made by the robot satellite, with the map of the United States imposed on it. We have a good deal of fun with direct overhead vertical photographs, as these are documents of the various disciplines that use the aerial camera. We're looking here at the city of London, which is a very different human habitation, you can see, from the city of Paris, dramatically illustrated by the contrast in the layout of the city shown by the aerial camera. Here is the city of Tokyo, a city you can easily see has not got proper street numbers. In contrast, we see this new pattern on the world landscape, which is American suburbia. We get here a closer look at American suburbia in Levittown in New Jersey, and that contrasts with a city of the poor, the city of Lagos in Nigeria. Such pictures convey immense amounts of information, and these brief glimpses suggest the immense compression of information that aerial photography can give us, and it gives us equivalent insights into the Earth's natural landscape. We have here the product of a marvelous development in extension of human vision. This is the product of the electron scan, of the scanning electron microscope. The little creature, this splendid little creature, is a tardigrade. It's magnified in the original picture in Scientific American 150 times. Here it must be magnified 1,500 times, and is a surely a splendidly formidable animal. What what the scanning electron microscope gives us, we might call, is what we might call a macroscope. Makes it possible to see in a vivid way objects that are above the strictly microscopic in size. Here we have a marvelous thing that can be done with the electron with the scanning electron microscope. We can zoom. We have a precipitation of red blood cells. In the top picture, we take a closer look. In the next picture, and we take a look at one blood cell in the third picture. A marvelous way to connect the large to keep one's orientation as one gets into the wonderful detail that is opened up by this instrument. Here we have a living cell in the classical electron micrograph, which has so vastly expanded our understanding of the structure and physiology and anatomy of the living cell. The diagram made from this beautiful electron micrograph over here identifies something more than a dozen of the organelles of the living cell with which molecular biologists are beginning to conjure. We go now to drawings, and these are just as much documents of science as the products of the telescope and the microscope are, because it is the formation in the mind's eye of structures and images of this kind by the visual imagination of the scientists, especially those who have been working in molecular biology in recent years, that is at the essence of so much of their work, that has demonstrated the persisting and marvelously logical relationship of form to function, down to the most microscopic, down indeed to the molecular and atomic level of reality. What we have here are the four, one, two, three, four bases that make up DNA, and this fifth inconvenient one that's labeled, that's printed here in red, guanine, which is the base that appears in RNA. And you all know the wonderful story that the bases pair up in pairs, and this makes it, what this gives us is the complementary chain of the in the DNA double-stranded molecule. It doesn't matter. It doesn't. We don't need to read the letters if we'll just remember that this double one up here and this double one up here can only hold hands with this single one, and this double one can only hold hands with that single one. But they can't hold hands with each other, so that when you have this one, that one must be in the other chain. When you have this one in a chain, then we must have that one in the other chain. So what we have is the possibility of writing a code, of forming letters. And it turns out that combinations of three of the bases in a row will encode the information that will preside at the assembly of the 20 different amino acids that make up the protein molecule. So we get four different bases in the DNA molecule. We get this spare one in RNA that substitutes for one of the bases in DNA. With four different letters in combinations of three, you get 4^3 power, or you get 64 different possible combinations of four in sets of three. That gives you plenty of letters to specify an alphabet of a little more than 20, and we see next how that works. First of all, we look at the replication of a DNA chain. A, C, A, G, you see. A hooks to T, so wherever you have an A, you have a T facing it. Wherever you have a C, you have a G. Wherever you have a G, you have a C. The two chains come apart. Each one forms its complement. The chain has been reproduced in the fourth frame. Here the DNA, a double strand of DNA replicates itself with a strand of RNA. The picture is in backwards, it turns out, but it doesn't matter. And the RNA strand conveys the information from the nucleus of the cell out into the cell protoplasm where the biosynthetic process goes forward. Here we have the whole picture in a single diagram, the double strand of DNA, the strand of RNA, the RNA strand in place, then the so-called transfer RNAs pick up fragments of, they pick up amino acid units and put them in place in the order specified by the bases in the strand of RNA, and the amino acids are zipped together to form a protein. Marvelous, nature was marvelous and generous in making a process which, however inadequately I may have explained it here, is so simple and made it possible to crack the genetic code. From here on, the physiology of the cell and the biochemistry is of enormous complexity, but here was a marvelous entry that brought the revolution in the contemporary revolution in molecular biology. And here was the way the first break in the genetic code was made. It was made by making a nonsense string of RNA, consisting of codons, that is, units of three uracils. So it's three U's at a time, three U's at a time, three U's at a time. The U's are complementary to the X's, and so a string of uracils gives us a string of proteins made up of the same identical amino acid. So instead of we get a polypeptide made up of the single amino acid that is specified by the uracil. And this was a simple and beautiful experiment that showed the complementarity of the transfer to the messenger RNA and the complementarity of the amino acid carried by a given transfer RNA. And these pictures, which serve to explain and illuminate the text in Scientific American, are pictures formed in the imagination of the investigators as they did their work. So they are as much a part of the process of doing the work as they are a part of the process of its explanation and publication. We have here the spiral helix of the alpha form of the protein. This was Linus Pauling's great discovery, that the bonding by the hydrogen across the interior of the helix formed the helix, that the helix itself is the simplest structural form that could be made from a chain of molecules to give it rigidity and structure and form. The beta helix, the beta configuration is the union typical of crystalline structures in proteins, where two chains line up and are held together by their hydrogen bonds. The hydrogen bonds now being used to bond two chains together rather than to form the helix. Then we get here in the next configuration a random chain of a protein. All three play their part in giving us, the picture got reversed again, but it doesn't matter, all three play a part in giving us the what appears to be the disordered, but is essentially the complex structure of the myoglobin molecule, the main function of which is to capture and hold here an atom of iron, which atom of iron is there to capture an atom of oxygen for delivery, for transfer of the oxygen from hemoglobin to its site in the muscle cell, firing up the combustion of energy in the muscle cell. This whole glorious little cage represents something on the order of 2,500 amino acids and thousands of individual atoms, the location of every one of which is now specified within tiny fractions of a wavelength of light. And we now begin to understand out of this comprehension, we now begin to understand the dynamics of these molecules, how they change in shape to receive and to accept one another, or to carry the functional atoms that they deliver to crucial sites in the physiological process. Here we look at the most important plastic of life, the plastic out of which most of our bodies consists, the plastic called collagen. Collagen is a triple strand. It's formed of only two amino acids. I can't read them here and I forget their names, but they differ only in that one of them carries a side group. They otherwise are identical with one another. The helix is the classical alpha helix is formed. Then the helix becomes a super helix by being twisted about itself. That's a typical single strand. Three of those strands make the collagen fibril. The fibrils lined up alongside one another and held together by the beta kind of bonding gives us the periodicity arises out of the overlap of the superhelixes with one another, and there appears the periodicity shows up in the striation of the molecule of the formed fiber. And here we get a look again at the structure from the fibril on up to the fiber, and then we have an electron micrograph of collagen fibers, of collagen fibrils. How do scientists form get such exact information about the structure and size and shape of molecules? This is one way, shining a light through a colloidal suspension of a given molecule. And the measurement then of the degree to which the light's refracted, to the degree to which the light is absorbed, the degree to which the light is diffused. Those three measurements taken together give beautiful information about the size and the shape of the molecule. And this technique depends upon work published by Albert Einstein in 1905. We see here the visual imagination of a scientist. These are original drawings by Clark Maxwell of his visions of the structure and distribution of forces in an electrical field. Here again, the visual imagination. Here is L.S. Penrose, a British mathematician, attacked the problem of how molecules could be self-replicating. And on strictly logical grounds, built in his imagination these marvelous little structures made up of latches and catches, and we needn't detain ourselves to consider just how they work, but the basic idea is that as a result of shuffling these together randomly, this structure can be made, this one for example, can be made to reproduce itself and the question here was how many latches were necessary, by what sequence should their opening and closing be controlled, and on these purely logical considerations, what ought we look for in the structure of the molecules? Here we have spread out on the infrared spectrum, and the infrared spectrum is a narrow band of the larger spectrum up here in the top row. We have laid out the behavior of the atoms that corresponds to their signals, of the molecules that corresponds to their signals on the spectrogram. And this signal is given by the stretching of the bonds. This one's given by the wagging, and so on. And what we're talking about here is, of course, pure and beautiful metaphor that works wonderfully for the purposes of understanding. And the remarkable part of it is that when experiments get closer to reality, it turns out these metaphors pretty much describe reality. Here we have the logic of nerve circuitry laid out in a diagram. Nerve circuits are very much like computer circuits in that we have to work with only the on and the off state, the firing or the not firing. On the other hand, we have an order of complexity that we don't dare start to conjure with in the design of computers yet, in that nerve circuits will fire inhibitory signals as well as excitatory signals. And we have here some logical diagrams that are addressed to the question of how information can be conveyed through a network of excitatory and inhibitory cells, cells that are in their linkage with one another cause the impulse to be excitatory and or inhibitory. And this is the beginning of the understanding of the basic units of organization and structure in the central nervous system. Beyond this, we've got something from the pure imagination. This is the way Eccles envisions the flow of information in the associative patterns of the cerebral cortex. And each of the different colored dots stands for circuits that are excited by one another, and we get loops of self-excitatory and reverberatory circuits that may have something to do with memory. We have paths of intersection where they cross with one another and mutually excite one another. This is all in the realm of speculation, but it's this kind of illustration in our magazine, as I say, is by way of explaining, the author explaining to his reader, but it's also the way he explains it to himself. We're looking here at the sun, as we'll never see it, of course, in reality, but here is the latest picture of the interior structure of the sun. This is an illustration packed with information that represents years and years of study of the sun and the observation of the configurations of its external sunspots related to purely theoretical propositions about its structure. Here we have J. Tuzo Wilson's continental drift and the collision of the rafts of the tectonic plates of the subduction zone here at the edge of a continent where the seafloor is diving below the continent, the overriding tectonic plate of the continent, and so on. We're looking here at the division of the seafloor at the rising of a convection current in the Earth's mantle. Again, the reality as we'll never see it with our eyes, but reality as envisioned from increasingly solid body of evidence. This is a map, and it's a map you can't do much with from where you're sitting, but the map is a classical mode for the organization and structuring of information. It's a visual index to vast volumes of information. I love this particular map of the Antarctic because as we designed it, and you can't see it here, but the fact is that the Antarctic is a continent of a continent of ice the actual land surface is are the gray areas here, but this is a situation where the glacier is stranded on the sea bottom. You know, we wouldn't have life on Earth, we ought to be reminded occasionally, if water didn't expand above its freezing point, and so that ice floats on water. But here, the ice reaches to the sea bottom and forms the continent across from the main body of the continent to a little archipelago, which is actually an island arc. An island arc typical of the island arcs that we now understand more about as a result of our understanding of the processes of continental drift. Darn it. This is a diagram of the flow of energy in a natural system. And the one bit of information that I think you can all get from here is that out of the marvelous torrent and flow of sunlight, there is just this much, this thin little green line that is captured by the process of photosynthesis. And that much absorbed by the leaf, this much rejected as heat, this much captured in the chemical bond. It's that tiny percentage of the total inward flood of sunlight on the Earth upon which all life depends. This is a diagram of the flow of energy in an industrial society. And we have it here by sources. We have the movement of energy across from one source to the other, as for example, coal is used to make electricity and so on. We get this much waste at this end, this much of useful energy. This is a pretty good, about 50-50 split in the capture of energy in useful work or light or warmth or indoor comfort as against that which is wasted. This is a rather typical effort of ours to use the visual image to structure and relate a great deal of information brought together in one place. Here is a dramatic curve, which is the work of M. King Hubbard. We're looking at the fossil fuel age. We start 1,000 years ago and look 1,000 years ahead from the year 2000, and this is the duration of the fossil fuel age at based upon our present rate of increase of consumption and the estimate of the Earth's resources. Here, packed into a single little diagram, is a vivid and significant historical fact about our lives. And I close here with the cover of our September 1952 issue. It's another painting by Walter Murch. This is James Watt's real invention. Now, he's credited with the steam engine. In truth, what he invented was the flyball governor. And the flyball governor is the essence of the control device of the automatic control systems of our contemporary technology. It uses the feedback of a tiny volume of energy from the output side to control the input of energy to the process. Well, this has been fun for me, and I thank you all for your rapt attention. No.
We have a privilege today, which I think is very important for the many addicts of Scientific American. That is to relieve the biggest frustration one has with the magazine. You know, you pick it up, and you want to ask questions. It would be very nice if one, each time one had the magazine, also had the publisher or editor at one's shoulder, so one could ask questions. Well, tonight we have him here, and we can ask questions. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think questions of value are as worthy of our concern for truth as any question about the facts is, just as worthy of our rational process and our honest effort to get at the evidence. Now, with respect to race, it seems to me that our understanding from biochemistry and the biology of the genetic process today, the utter baselessness of racial distinctions is wiped out. I think we owe this, I think this is a historic fact about man's advancing understanding of himself, and I think it's an illustration of my point that this notion that there was some division of labor between the faculties of arts and science ought to be set aside, that science is as deeply engaged in questions of value as the humanities are, and these are the inescapable and so often the most important questions that confront a scientist. Sir. That was sheer luck. Actually, we found him in Popular Science, where he had a monthly puzzle. And it was clear to us that we should have such a column, and we had looked all over. I remember once calling upon a magnificent figure named Jacuthiel Ginsburg, who was the editor of Scripta Mathematica, and a marvelous round abbot with his yarmulke, and he sat there heaving with merriment at the thought of our being interested in such a column, and assured me that there were only 5 puzzles. Well, I think Martin Gardner has demonstrated that there are more than 5. And has done this now with the collaboration of a readership that generates an enormous correspondence. And I've scarcely been anywhere in the world that I haven't encountered a Martin Gardner fan. And
other questions? Yes.
What do you call your Italian edition?
It's called Le Scienze, and it says very plainly, Edizione Italiano, the Scientific American in our logotype. If I had the privilege of doing it over again, our working title for our magazine was The Sciences. We accepted the pragmatic uses of the old magazine for economizing on our requirement for venture capital, and when it came into the world as Scientific American. I like to feel as an American citizen that we fly the American flag the way I want to see it flown when we publish abroad. There are simply topics that we want to cover that can't be dealt with fully and adequately in the compass of a single article. And once we did this, and it was really the issue on automatic control for which that James Watt flyball governor was painted, that set the model. And from that time on, as each year comes around, we say, well, should we do this again? And we always have, out of a standing and rolling forward wave of topics, one that we really want to get to. And this year we'll be on the subject of food and the problem of how we are going to feed another 3.5 billion people who are going to join us on this earth between now and the year 2000. We consider that those questions are settled when we have got the best advice we can solicit on an invitation to an author. And our articles are not refereed. What we do to a manuscript is subject, of course, to the author's full correction, review, and approval. And he okays everything before the article goes to press, but no one else sees it. And so we do not referee the articles. To the extent, as I said, we have an entirely informal and constantly changing network of counselors, and it is conducted on a strictly informal basis. And so, you've asked a question that reaches the jugular. This is the point where our personal responsibility for what goes in the magazine is really lodged. It's in those decisions.
Have you made any embarrassing mistakes?
We've never published an article that we really wished we hadn't. We've had the marvelous experience of seeing authoritative articles that we have published being totally displaced and turned on their heads by later developments. As for example, we published a classic and beautiful piece of writing by Professor Bucher at Columbia that produced the classical statement of the isostatic explanation for the mountain building and other geological processes, just ante the publication of the J. Tuzo Wilson piece, when continental drift began to explain the processes that Dr. Bucher had so ingeniously explained by another theoretical model. So we have had that experience, and that is part of the life of science, and I hope someday to publish an anthology of pairs of articles, of such articles, that will help the teaching of science to students who still today make the mistake of thinking that science is somehow engraven on tablets and people go and look it up someplace. That it's, they don't realize that it's an intense human and creative activity that comes out of the adversary process and an encounter of trained minds. I can't think of an unsolicited article. We have unsolicited proposals of articles, which we welcome, and some authors that know us will write us and tell us they have got a piece of work that they really feel they'd like to write about in our magazine, and then friends of authors who are shy will write us, and so we do receive unsolicited proposals, But the scientific community is a small and permeable enough one so that information gets around and people do know that we... And so a scientist doesn't sit down and write a piece. Although we do get unsolicited pieces that we don't publish.
Other questions?
I beg your pardon. Do I get the question?
He wants you to elaborate on the relationship of value to life. That's an enormous elaboration. I think we better treat that afterwards.
Well, if you're talking about the relation of value to science again, I mean, if we're returning to that subject, there's another element in the picture that has to do with the relation of science to value. What? Oh.
Oh.
Oh, sure. Well, that was, as a matter of fact, yeah, all right. The relationship of tools to value. I think there is an intense and deeply significant one. In that, tools change the condition of man. Tool making changes the human condition. And with change in the human condition comes new possibilities of human life, which makes possible new choices, which calls for which lays the foundations for new values. Values are man-made. Values evolve with human institutions and with human experience, and with the new potentials of human existence that are opened up in particular by man's expanding control of his environment and through understanding and the application of understanding of objective knowledge. Look, a simple-minded demonstration of this is the fact that chattel slavery is now technologically obsolete. It's therefore is now recognized to be immoral. Yes, sir.
Yes. You mentioned earlier when you were talking about the computer and relieving human beings of this mental exercise, and you suggested that when we were relieved of muscular activity and mental activity, there would be no economic pressure, and then we'd have time to develop our truly artistic senses and so on. This doesn't seem to be the experience that the economic incentive seems to produce good art. This is exemplified here, for instance, in the Pacific Northwest and in the Arctic, the Eskimos and the Indians. It's very difficult now to get the same quality, artistic quality, that we had when there was more of an economic necessity for them to do this. The welfare payments doesn't seem to relieve people of their other anxieties to such an extent that they spend all their time doing artistic work.
Well, I think that there are about three layers on that onion, if you'll forgive the image. In the first place, I was not talking about mental activity or muscular activity. I was talking about drudgery. And the entire propriety of relieving human beings of drudgery. Men have sought to do so, and have sought the least effort solution for problems, and this is at the essence of the progress of technology from the beginning of time. Now we're succeeding at it, and succeeding at it to the point where people are really disengaged from drudgery in getting the world's work done, which I think raises the most marvelous and interesting and new possibility that people will now be able to use those capacities freely and for aesthetic and other motivations to do things that please them. Now, I would suggest that the primitive art that developed the aficionados did not come out of economic incentive. The primitive art in use in the Eskimo village was not a product of economic incentive. It was propitiation of gods, or it came out of other motives, but not economic. When it got commercialized, it got unhinged and disengaged from its original setting, and heaven knows what real authenticity it carried in its latter phases, but it surely was going to lose its original aesthetic impulse. And I don't think that if they find living on relief preferable to doing art for those purposes, then they probably, at least they're right from their own point of view in making that choice, and they can't be kept working at art because people down here want them to do it. They're only going to do good art if they enjoy doing it. What we have attempted to do is, the question was, would I comment on the role of Scientific American in the debate on arms control? What we have tried to do, and contribute to this subject, is to provide the public with disengaged and disinterested counsel from informed authorities. And otherwise, the information tends to come from those with an economic or political or other interest in the promotion of new weapon systems. The authors of the articles that we have published under this heading are scientists and engineers who have worked in, the leader of them, I mean, one of the leading figures among them is Herbert York, who is now at University of California at San Diego, who by his own testimony spent his adult life in the arms race. He did his graduate work in the Lawrence Radiation Laboratory, working on the original weapon systems, and was the first head of the Livermore Laboratory. Herbert York